I'm HRN's Communications Director Kat Johnson with a preview of this week's episode of Meat in Three.
I think we should realize that we more or less have a broken food system. When 800 million of us go to bed hungry, 600 million are obese, we waste 30% of our food, then something is fundamentally wrong.
We'll introduce you to one food waste solution happening in Asia.
They introduced a system where residents were issued an electronic ID card that would open an automated bin and enable them to weigh the food waste being dropped off. And then they would be charged, you know, in a certain amount of money for the weight of that food.
And we'll take a look at some of the real struggles happening closer to home.
How is it possible that a meal that was perfectly fine to consume at 10:59 p.m. then becomes waste at 11 p.m.
So tune in to this week's Meat in Three on Heritage Radio Network, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
Welcome to Food Without Borders, a show about food, politics, and identity. I'm your host, Sari Kamen, and you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org. My guest today is Essie Bartels. She's a food entrepreneur and the founder of Essie Spice, a small batch spice and sauce company inspired by Essie's upbringing in Ghana and her travels.
Yeah, is that good?
That's pretty accurate.
Welcome to the show, Essie.
Thank you.
I'm glad that was accurate because I put that one together.
Yeah. Well, you got it.
I nailed it.
Yep, you
awesome.
Did.
Well, I'm so glad you're here. You came all the way from the great state of New Jersey. Not as far as Ghana,
but it is a trip. It is a trip, especially because where I live is not by very good transportation. So you have to drive and park and take the bus and take the train.
I appreciate it. And you will be rewarded with pizza.
Love it. Love it.
Which is, I think, the reason why most people agree to come to the interview.
Great.
Well, I'm so happy you're here. I would love to kind of just start a little bit at the beginning to hear about you and your life in Ghana and your upbringing. I read that you were responsible for doing the cooking of your entire family.
Well, to some extent, when I was a little bit older, I definitely had to take charge of that. But when I was younger, my mom would be like, I'm cooking, but you need to be here at all times. Even if I knew how to make whatever it is she was making, like frying an egg or making rice, she's like, I don't care, you still have to be here. So
why was it so important for her?
I think obviously culturally, it's such a taboo back home. And I mean, things are changing now, but it's such a taboo to have a daughter that cannot cook, because then it's like a huge thing. Then she can't get married, right? And so, you know, she always wanted to make sure that I knew how to cook. And it didn't matter. I think it's something across a lot of African homes. It doesn't matter if you know how to make it. You still have to be in the kitchen because she might want you to pick up a spoon, which is right in front of her, but she wants you to pick it up for her. They do. African parents are crazy. But that's, you know, standard.
Were you the only girl of all the siblings?
I'm the second. I'm the first and my sister is the second. So there's two of us. But I was older. Mm-hmm. So I was in the kitchen a lot more than my sister. And then I think when she was in the kitchen a little bit more, I was in high school. So that changed. I wasn't there to experience her being there as well.
So you really learned how to cook at a pretty young age.
Definitely. I remember from like 7 or 8, I was like whipping up things.
What are, you know, some of the typical West African dishes that you grew up learning to cook and you remember your mom preparing for you?
I mean, a lot of our food is starchy. Mm-hmm. So we eat a lot of root vegetables and root tubers. So like yams, cassavas, cocoa yams. And then we also eat a lot of, cocoa yam leaves, cassava leaves. We eat a lot of soups, a lot of rice. I guess lots of vegetables, but a lot more of starches. I think because indigenously from before, a lot of us were farmers. And so you needed a lot of energy to go to the farm and keep you fueled for the whole day. So a lot of our meals were starch heavy. Things are changing now because we're learning that that's not so great, especially now that we're not in the farm the whole day. Most of us are in offices and sure. doing all of that. So, yeah, having a bowl of fufu, which is like one of the most typical dishes made with cassava in the morning before you go to work is not ideal. But those are pretty much our main dishes. Lots of root tubers, vegetables, soups, and vegetables, usually vegetables from the root tubers, and a lot of fish as well, because we're by the coast. Mm-hmm. So we get a lot of fish from the sea. And we also have the largest man-made lake in Ghana. Hmm. I think China is building a new one that might make it bigger than what we have. But until then, it is the largest in the world. So we get a lot of fish from there as well.
So you decided to leave Ghana when you were 18 and come to the United States. What was the reason you wanted to leave?
So I was moving because of college. I wanted to come to college in the U.S. And so that's what brought me here. I remember speaking to my dad about it, and he said, if you get a scholarship to go to university in the U.S., then you can go. If you don't get a scholarship, then you're going to stay here and you're going to go to a local university. So I got a scholarship, and so I got to come to school here, and I've been here ever since.
Mm-hmm. How does your parents feel about you leaving? I mean, it sounds like your mom was sort of grooming you to have like a typical...
Very typical.
...life, like, you know, teaching you how to cook so you could get married and then thwarted that plan.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And also because I'm her first daughter. Mm. So, I mean, a lot of pressure. It was a lot of pressure, but my mom had to look at the big picture and see that, yes, I'm leaving, but I'm not just, you know, taking a trip. I'm going to get an education and then hopefully get a career out of that. And so I think as much as it was hard for her, she understood what the benefit will be eventually. Because I remember when I came here in August, I mean, I had spent a couple of summers in London because my mom's siblings live in England. But it rains a lot in London, but it's never as cold as it is here in the U.S. Mm-hmm. So I had never experienced that kind of cold when I moved to Scranton, Pennsylvania, which is like in the Poconos in Pennsylvania. Where they showed the office, yes.
That's where understanding of Scranton,
yes,
Pennsylvania.
Yes, there's literally nothing there, nothing there. So I got here, I was extremely depressed. I grew up in a big city, so I come from a big metropolitan city like Accra, and I moved to Scranton, Pennsylvania, which is like the buses were stopping at 6 in the evening. That's how rural it was. I mean, things may have changed now. And it was extremely cold. I cried so much. My mom flew here the following month because I was like, I'm ready to come back home. She's like, no, 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 you're not.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I would have thought she would scooped you right up.
No, she's like, no, we've already committed. You're staying. You're going to finish this.
Good on you,
you're
mom.
You're not the first person to do this, so suck it up. But she came. She came to reassure me that it was all going to be okay.
That's a good
mom. Yeah, she is.
So what other kinds of culture shock did you experience when you came to the U.S.? I imagine the food was different. The people were different.
I mean, Scranton is on another level of culture shock. I mean, first of all, the U.S.
For New Yorkers, it would be culture shock going to Scranton.
Exactly. For New Yorkers as well. But, you know, of course, the food, finding local food that, you know, we eat, like finding things like cassava, finding yams, finding palm oil, finding dried fish, you know, none of that was available. So my mom would bring it to me when she was coming, or I would get it when I went to New York and come to these African stores that are available here. There's nothing there. So that's that. Of course, there was also a little bit of racism. Mm-hmm. My school was a private Catholic university, so there was about I would say literally while I was there, there was maybe 15 black people out of 3,500 population. So you could count everybody, all the black people knew each other. It was that small. And so everywhere you went, you know, people knew who you were. I remember one of the times, another culture shock that I was just baffling was striving to get an A in class, and people would get C's and D's and they were like excited. I just never got that. Like they were like, oh my God, I passed.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. And it's like my parents are, I got a partial scholarship. It was about half of the tuition. And then eventually I became an RA so that my parents didn't have to pay anything. But the first year they had to still cover the rest of the tuition. So I'm thinking to myself, my parents have to come up with all this money, change it into dollars from CDs and pay this tuition. And I'm not going to come here and get a C and be excited about it. That doesn't even make sense to me. But people are getting C's and D's and they're just thrilled because they passed and they can move on to the next class.
Yeah, that's some privilege right there.
That was ridiculous privilege. Yeah. And I understand.
It manifests as just laziness and apathy.
Exactly. But the thing is, if you don't know the value of things, then you behave that way. There were people, of course, that were striving to get A's just like me because they understood why they were there. But there's a majority of people that were just like, yeah, I just need to get a C or a C minus or a C plus just to get out.
Yeah.
That's, yeah.
Well, I hope if not, like the only takeaway is that it was, you know, motivating for you to
absolutely. Work that much harder. Oh, absolutely. I'm just like, yeah, I'm going to crush all these people.
Yeah, exactly. So you went to school to pursue business.
Yes.
And then something shifted. I mean, you're still in business.
Right.
You shifted towards food.
Right,
what was
exactly.
The pivot there? Were you just so nostalgic for the food you ate growing up that you had to like create it?
I guess part of me was, but so I went to school for international business and management and I minored in French. And so I spent 3.5 years in the US and 6 months in France. It was a great exposure, great, you know, meeting people from all over the world. I came back and got a great job at Hitachi as a Japanese company and worked my way up through different companies in global procurement. And I was doing great. I was going from one company to the other, you know, advancing my career, getting the exposure, getting the experience and making more money. So it was perfect. But on the side, every other couple of weeks, something I would always do is cook and invite my friends over to come eat at home.
That is a good way to make friends, by the way. Especially where you're somewhere, you feel a little bit out of your element.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And it was probably a wonderful way for you to introduce yourself to people and kind of explain your story.
1,000%. And it started in college where I was president of the international club and we needed money because that year the president that left before didn't get enough money for the budget for us to do the things we wanted to do. So we didn't have enough money for that year when I was president. So we had to come up with a way to raise money for the group, the club. So I'm like, well, what I know how to do is to cook. So let's cook different things and let's make all the noise and let's get people excited to eat. And that was, I think, one of the things that was like, you know, I feel like everything that's happened to me and with me is gearing me up for what is coming up, you know, for my future, for my career, and for my business. Because even with procurement, everything I did with negotiating and procuring and operations and logistics is everything I did. And I'm still using all of that expertise for SC Spice. But the pivot was after cooking for my friends and, you know, over and over and them telling me, oh, this is good, whatever, this is amazing. I'm just like, yeah, you just want to come and eat. It's not that great. It's not nothing more than what you would get at like, you know, Peter's house or whoever's house. It's probably the same thing. But they just kept going over and over. And one day, one of my friends came over, brought his cousin, and his cousin said, I'm going to give you, you know, X amount of money and I want you to cook, you know, two or three things for me. So I cooked for him, and then I was like, so I can cook for somebody and get all this money? Like, I only spent, like, let's say 30% of the money on the ingredients. So the 70% was mine. And I'm thinking, wow, that's a lot of money for just cooking these things. And he was literally about to do somersaults. So
yeah,
then
for you, it was just so intrinsic.
Exactly. This is what I do on a normal.
You do this with your eyes closed.
And but then for him, he's like, this is crazy. Like, do you know what you're doing? This is like,
he's probably never tasted anything like that before.
Or not as good.
Not as well, that's what I mean. Yeah.
So then he says, Essie, I don't know what you want to do with this talent, but whenever you decide, let me know and I'll support you with money, with cash. So I'm like, yeah, whatever. So then I had to sit. So I had to sit down and really think about this. I'm like, what can I do with food that's not already on the market and doesn't require intense capital right away, like opening a restaurant or mm-hmm. any of that? Because I, in my mind, anything, you know, being in the culinary world was not something that I saw myself in, because growing up, it wasn't something that was really encouraged. You know, being a chef or being a cook or owning a restaurant wasn't really like an in thing. Nobody was really encouraged to cook.
And it was like the stigma was that it was a domestic choice.
Exactly. It's a domestic choice. It was like, oh, you're going to go and be a lawyer. You're going to be, be in business. You're going to be a engineer, that kind of thing. And it still is. I mean, things are changing because parents are seeing that my child is a photographer and he's doing well and he's being paid. So I got to let him be. But mm-hmm. it's a conversation that is changing. The landscape is changing now. But growing up, there was no such thing as being a chef, you know?
Yeah.
It wasn't glorified at all. So it was like, what am I going to do that's going to be impactful and reach people wherever they are in America? And I was like, okay, I'm going to create my sauces, because these were sauces that I already made to make my life easier when I was cooking. And so now I was like, okay, I have to figure out how to bottle them. Mm. So I have four products. I have the mango chili, which is a chili made with hot scotch bonnets with mango, coconut oil, and avocado oil. So I always used to make that because it made my cooking easier, because once I was ready to cook, let's say, fish or chicken or shrimp or noodles, I just pour a little bit in there and I have the flavor ready to go. So that's something I always used to make. I'm like, okay, we'll bottle that. And then in one of my trips, I traveled to Mexico and I got tamarind candies. And when I tasted them, I remembered that I had tasted something like that, but I couldn't remember what it was. But growing up in Ghana, I literally used to pick the tamarind from the trees. I just didn't know that it was the same exact thing. See how everything just comes full circle?
Yeah.
So when I was doing my research, come to find out it's actually a very tropical West African plant that was spread all over the world. And so I came back from that trip. I had the candies, but they were too sweet because tamarind is usually a little bit sour. And so they put a lot of sugar in it. And I'm like, I can't eat these candies, but I don't want to throw them away. What am I going to do to still use them in some way? So then I put them on the fire, added a little water, got a syrup, and I put them on chicken wings. And I'm like, this is incredible. People are going to like this to cook with. So that's going to be my second one. And then the spice rub, that's something that you would find on literally any street in Ghana, in Senegal, in Togo, in Nigeria. That's a spice blend that we use to season meats, fish, chicken, guinea fowl. It's like our barbecue rub. Mm-hmm. It's called suya. In Nigeria, it's called suya. In Ghana, they just call it kebab pepe. It's so good. So, but what I liked about that is that it blended very well with spices that I loved from Asia. So that's how I blended that fusion and I got my spice rub. Then the last one was inspired by my time in Europe, because I loved the way they would use garlic and roasted bell peppers and tomatoes and oils. And so I came up with my coco for garlic sauce, which is similar to what I would have had there, like a garlic sauce, but with coconut oil, which is very indigenous to Ghana as well. Right. So that's how the crazy mixes came together, and that's how I decided to start it.
Okay. Well, I am getting very hungry listening to you talk. We're going to take a quick break.
Okay.
Have a commercial, and we'll be right back with Essie Bartels.
All right.
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. The Hearst family has been raising cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of California's Central Coast for over 150 years. Piedra Blanca Rancho in San Simeon is the original Hearst Ranch, founded by George Hearst in 1865. George's son was the famous publisher William Randolph Hearst. In addition to being known for building the iconic Hearst Castle, William was, like his father before him, an avid rancher. In his words, "I would rather spend a month at the ranch than any place in the world." Thanks to one of the largest land conservation easements in California history, a joint effort with the California Rangeland Trust, the American Land Conservancy, and the state of California, the working landscape at Hearst Ranch will be preserved forever. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
I'll just put this back on.
Hey, you're listening to Food Without Borders. This is HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Sari Kamen, and I'm in studio today with Essie Bartels. She is the founder of Essie Spice, which is her spice and sauce company. So, Essie, you were just talking about the four products in your line, which made me feel very hungry. They all sound so delicious. Mm-hmm. And basically like the birth of your company.
Yep.
So how did it go from
corporate to just transitioning to the sauces? So
yeah, but also just like, how did you grow a company? Like, how did you know,
right.
You had the concept, you had a little bit of seed,
right?
But now you're like in Whole Foods. Like, how did you really grow it?
Absolutely. So, when I started, before I even launched a product, this was the wee years of Facebook. I would post my food, whatever I made, because people would always say, "Oh, you do this and it's so great," and da da da. So I would cook, and then I would say, "Oh, this is what I made today. Whatever, I made the sauce, I made jollof, I made the stew," and I would post it. And I started getting a following from that, of people that were interested in what I was cooking.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I did decide, after I spoke to my friend Kwame, who gave me the money to start, those people were already there. And I guess they were hungry for something, because they were already liking things suggestions I had. You know, it wasn't very structured. It was pretty much whatever I was cooking or whatever I liked. So if I went to a restaurant and I liked it, I'll talk about it, or the food that I ate there. But
and this was still sort of like
a hobby.
Yeah. And also when, you know, food media wasn't so saturated.
No,
like,
yes,
not everyone
was
like Instagramming every single thing they ate.
No. And this was a time where there weren't sponsored posts and all of this, you know, influencers.
Right.
And all.
Not everyone had a blog.
No. Social media was not that saturated and like bombarded. And so people, if they liked your stuff, they liked your stuff, and they would come back and check you out all the time.
Yeah,
and it was organic.
I miss those days. It's like more sincere.
I know.
It's not just like.
It's crazy because I have people now who ask me when we go to like events. I went to an event at The Wing, and these other small businesses that are starting now are like, "Oh my God, how did you grow your following to 13,000? I can't even get 1,000 followers." And I'm like, it's because when I started, it wasn't like this.
Yeah, it's too much competition.
There was too many, there's too many, even when you open your app, there's too many things. Like, there's too many suggestions and things mm-hmm. coming up and options. Like, even Instagram wasn't the way it was, you know, where it has the explore page and IGTV. None of that was there when I started. And so Instagram wasn't even around, or if it was, it wasn't in the beta stage or whatever. So all I did was post on Facebook. And so that's how I got the followers coming in, like wanting the product. And so when I launched in the beginning, they were already there. But still, even though I had launched the product, I still had an incredible job and making all this money, and it was very flexible. My commute was like 8 minutes to work. I worked with Unilever. I loved my company. I loved my boss. And because it was so flexible, I could do that and SC Spice at the same time, and it was okay.
Wow.
And so I was like, I'm not going to quit this job for the sauce. But it got to this point in about 2 years in with SC Spice where I felt like I should have gotten to a certain stage by now with SC Spice. Why am I not there? So I figured that I needed more money. I needed to give it more time. And I needed to be able to, let's say, hire somebody. But I figured if I, with the money that I'm getting from SC Spice, it won't be enough to hire somebody. So maybe get another job, which might not be so comfortable. It will make me more money, then I can hire somebody part-time to really go and get a lot of the stuff done. So I left Unilever very unwillingly, but thinking, you know, I'm making this decision for my brand and for the future. You know, I got like $40,000 more at the new job. More money, but it was like an hour and a half commute every day. So my life changed from an 8 minute commute to an hour and a half every day.
Wow.
My life changed from having a very flexible job and a very flexible boss and a very flexible working environment to being watched and literally monitored when I came in, when I left, when, you know. It was just ridiculous. It was like black and white at the new company. It was horrible. I hated it. Mm-hmm. I hated my commute. I hated everything. I hated the culture. Mm-hmm. I literally, so the I believe it was like 3 weeks in, I had started the new job. My boss's wife was in a very horrible accident. Mm. And he was home the whole time because, of course, his wife, I think she even shattered like bones in her leg. So I understand that you have to be home, but there was nobody to train me. Mm. And I went from being in a position in a career where I would speak to people and negotiate contracts and have face-to-face interactions with people to this new job where I'm sitting by a computer every single day moving contracts in a software that I didn't have training in. Yeah. So you can imagine how frustrated I was. I was already angry. And then, you know, things were not working very well. So I believe they knew. I feel like they knew they were going to let me go, because when I asked to join the company, when I was told I was going to get the job, I let them know that in November, when I turned 30, I was going to take some extended time off. So I was let go the day before I was supposed to leave.
Wow.
Yeah. Crazy times. But like, honestly, when I got that call, I was sitting in a car and heading to the office, and I stopped, and literally in that same breath where I was like, I can't believe this is happening, I was like, this is it. Like, I feel so relieved. Feel so relieved. And everybody around me knew I was miserable. My parents and my family and everybody's like, this job is horrible. Like, you are always sad. You're always upset. You're always stressed out. Nothing. I just didn't want to even talk to anybody.
Yeah.
So that was the turning point where I lost the job and I had other offers. I remember I had an offer from L'Oreal. I had some other offers from Mondelez, a couple other good companies. To get offers and work, and I decided that I was going to give SC Spice 6 months mm-hmm. of undivided attention where I wasn't working full-time. I was just going to concentrate on SC Spice for 6 months, and I was going to get unemployment anyway because I wasn't fired. I was just let go.
Mm-hmm.
So I was going to get unemployment. I was going to get all the benefits.
So that worked out even better.
So that, it did. So I gave myself the timeline. I said, in 6 months, if nothing happens, if I don't see something significant happen with SC Spice, I'll get another job. And so that's what I did. And in the 6 months, that's when I got interviewed by Time. I got into Whole Foods. And that was because I met with another lady who introduced me to this group in Harlem that helps people to get into Whole Foods. It's called Harlem Park to Park. And this was prior to Whole Foods coming into Harlem. So they had reached out to Harlem Park to Park to nurture small businesses that wanted to, because they wanted local producers from Harlem, which is something that Whole Foods has. They have like the local program where they try to source a lot of their products on their shelves from local producers. And at the time I was producing in Harlem. So she introduced me to the group. Unlike a lot of the other people there, I already had a product on the market that was ready. So they're like, well, your product is ready to go. We don't have any issues. And Harlem doesn't open for another year, but we have other stores. So let's start with those. And that's how we got into Whole Foods. And then, so Whole Foods, we got into ShopRite. We were on time. Then later Forbes came and all of this stuff.
That's
so
incredible.
That's when I was like, okay.
Yeah, you
I guess I'm going to stay.
That's amazing that you did that in 6 months.
It was literally like God telling me this is where you, because I feel like if it wasn't that monumental, I would have gone back.
Yeah.
I would have gone back to, because I liked my comfort. I liked having money in my, right. I like having my 401k. I like having that support. And now, I mean, I don't, it's like risking it all for this dream and this brand. But
yeah. So have you seen, you know, since the time you launched Essie Spice, or even since you came to the United States, do you see West African cuisine becoming more prevalent, or does it still seem like a cuisine that Americans are just basically not very educated about and don't have a lot of opportunities to taste?
They don't. I think since I've been here, it's gotten better, but it's still, there's so much more that can be done. And I feel like I feel like this is what's going to happen, because a lot of the stores and the brands and the magazines, they're not giving people like me and other people that are doing what I'm doing, either educating people about West African food or talking about our grains, our oils, our spices, etc., things that are only found on the continent. They're not giving us a chance because they just don't see how the uptake is going to be. But it's just going to take one person who believes in like, you know, the whole, just like how, you know, quinoa came and took over and quinoa is everywhere now from, you know, Peru. That's what's going to happen. We need a few stakeholders who believe in the products and believe in the ingredients and believe in what we're doing. And if they put a stamp on it, then everybody else is going to be like, oh, you know, I've always known about it. But no, we just need a few people to just champion it and to make noise about our food and the health benefits and why we grow to 100 and all of that stuff.
Do you see yourself as one of those ambassadors?
I am. Okay. I do see that. And I'm trying as much as possible, not just, you know, with this. So, you know, with the spices and the sauces that I sell, but also to educate people, you know, about the continent, especially about our food. And so when I go home, I'm, you know, doing stories. I'm telling people about, you know, farms and traditions and different grains and all of this stuff that, you know, they need to hear about that they may never have seen or heard or ever encountered, you know, because a lot of people that are not African don't go to the African stores. Mm-hmm. They don't have anything, they don't have any push to go there. But if we change the narrative where they're giving people like me and others that are doing food in this space a chance, then it's going to be mainstream, just like you have Asian food and you have Mexican food and you have Peruvian food and you have all of this food. West African, African food needs to be made famous as well.
Yeah. And I mean, I can't help but ask, do you feel like that feels even more crucial right now at this point of time in the United States, because there is a lot of negative rhetoric towards, you know, immigrants of all different backgrounds, but especially because there was that, you know, there was that one particular comment about Africans from the top, we'll call it. Does it feel more urgent to use food as sort of a conduit to help others understand like exactly who Africans are and,
you know, what it means to be African. Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, food can be a great way to help educate people.
Absolutely.
And it's just a way in. So does that feel part of like the motivation behind
1,000%? Like this is my story. Like I just applied for this other competition with Girl Boss and Uber. I hope I win. I'll find out soon. But the whole point is letting people know about our traditions and our cultures, and letting people know that, you know, just because you see and, you know, people in Peace Corps going to the Gambia and taking pictures with kids that have flies all over them, that is not the African story. And that is what Chimamanda said, is the horror of a single-sided story, because a lot of the times the reason why people or somebody will say something that daft is because there's one story that is told about Africa. And also the other side of it is that, yeah, we have incredible cities and we have incredible industries and we have 5, 6, 7 star hotels and we have all of this stuff and people have maids at home and all of that stuff. But that is also not the only story. There's a full circle of stories that needs to be told. So, you know, when you think of Africa, you're not thinking of the mansions and, you know, people living la vida loca, but you're also not thinking little kids, you know, in the jungle with flies around them, because both of them are African. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, you know, if people come to New York, they're going to see people sleeping on the streets and, you know, begging, or people in the subway, or first of all, our subways are one of the most disgusting subways in New York. When you go to Europe, you're like, you can sleep in the subway. It's so clean. You can take that story, or you can take people going to Soho House and having a drink. And that could be a New York story, because that's extremely lavish and all of that. So there's not one story to talk about New York. It's, you know, there's a full circle of what New York is. And that's the same way with Africa. And that's another thing. People don't even know that there's 53 countries in there. There's, you know, Ghana. I haven't even been to all of them. There's, you know, Ethiopia, and you literally, you go from one place to the other and it's like two completely, Namibia looks like a place out of Mars, you know, and then you go to Ghana and Congo, it's like tropical rainforest, and you go to Zimbabwe and Zambia, then you have Victoria Falls, and then you go to Egypt, and then you have pyramids. So it's like, the cultures are ridiculous. So when people lump us together like that, it's like, it doesn't even make sense.
Yeah.
Depending on where you go, it can be a completely different place. So that's what, yes, I really hope that I'm able to tell our story through food. So that it's not one-sided, and people are able to, maybe because of something I mentioned on our page, people will Google something and find out, you know how like the loop with YouTube, you start with one and then you watch something else and you watch something else, and then they get to learn a little bit more about, you know, I don't know, just everything.
Yeah.
There's just so much that even I don't know. And so, yeah, hopefully food will do it.
I hope so too. Essie, tell us where to find you on Instagram and social, and where we can like make sure we keep up with you and order your spices and sauces.
Absolutely. So everything is Essie Spice on all our social media, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. It's E-S-S-I-E and Spice, Essie Spice. So EssieSpice.com, you can order if you're not in the Northeast region, because we're not out in all the regions yet. We're only in Northeast right now, but you can order online and we'll ship right to you. But we're in if you go on the website, there's a list of stores that we're in. We're in Smithsonian in D.C. We're in New York. We're in Jersey and Connecticut. But we're getting out there. We're hopefully going to close a few accounts with national stores soon. And hopefully we'll be able to update you guys, if not by the end of the year, hopefully in Q1 of 2019, about new stores that we've landed. So fingers crossed.
Absolutely.
Prayers up.
Well, Essie, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Absolutely.
It was awesome to chat with you today. And
it was my pleasure.
Loved meeting you and hearing all about your spice journey.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. Check us out next week, same time, same place, Wednesday on heritageradionetwork.org, and always find us, Food Without Borders, on iTunes and Stitcher and Spotify.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.